dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this
week you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. For the past couple of months, I've been reading you from the book, The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and the Convergence of Crises That's Birthing the Transition, by the philosopher, mathematician, linguist, and healer Charles Eisenstein. Up to this point, he's been examining the fundamental ideology that underlies both our science and religion, our very civilization, which he calls the project of domination and control. In the preceding chapters, he's detailed the way this has led to the myriad problems we face and why it has resulted in the general dissatisfaction most people feel with life. This week, we begin a new phase of the book in which he attempts to show why our efforts to fix our problems only result in greater ones, that the very premises under which we operate, the story that we tell to explain reality, whether scientifically or spiritually, is false. Though we're in the 21st century, we are still living conceptually in the 17th. Today we begin Chapter 6, where he starts his modern re-envisioning of some very ancient understandings lost in the ascent of humanity during what he calls the Age of Separation. He asks, what would a science and technology look like in the future he posits, that he calls the Age of Reunion? So let us continue with The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein, published in 2006. Chapter 6, The Crumbling of Certainty, The End of Objectivity. The Age of Separation, in all its dimensions, has unfolded before us. The objectification and reduction of the world, the conversion of life into money, the program of understanding and control, the alienation of a discrete and separate self, are all reaching their historical zenith in our time. All of these facets of separation are bound together in the official dogma of our civilization, the religion of science. However, starting perhaps a century ago, new countercurrents have welled up from within science itself that are contributing to a gathering sea change. This momentous shift both drives and reflects even vaster changes, a wholesale transformation of all the dimensions of separation that comprise the ascent of humanity. Like most religions, science encompasses an ideology, a program, and a method. The ideology of science comprises our fundamental story of the world and how it works, our parsing of the possible into the real and the imaginary, and our definition of what types of knowledge are valid. The program of science is what I have named the scientific program. It is the ambition to become Descartes' lord and possessors of the physical universe, that is, to bring all phenomena into the realm of measurement, predictability, and control, so that all knowledge rests on a firm foundation of experimentally verifiable objective truth. The third element of the religion of science, the scientific method, draws its validity from the ideology of science and its motivation from the program of science. I've already discussed how the scientific method depends on the replicability of experiments, the testability of hypotheses, and ultimately on the assumptions of determinism and objectivity. Scientific inquiry in general, as well as a scientific rational approach to life, assumes that there is a reality out there that we can query, test, understand, and in due course predict and control. Herein lies the quest for certainty, in which understanding rises from a foundation of facts. By sticking with the facts and reasoning from there, we remain objective and obtain knowledge of superior reliability. The assumption of determinism encodes the conventional notion of causation and validates the technological program of control. It says that nothing happens that is not caused to happen. Events do not arise spontaneously, mysteriously, magically, without cause. Events follow predictability from causes. If we can learn the causes of phenomena, then master those causes, then we become the masters of reality. Without sufficient understanding, there is nothing that might not someday be brought into the human realm. I want to emphasize how deeply determinism is woven into our belief system. Do the same thing in the same way, and you have to get the same result. You see someone strike a flint and get a spark. You try it and it doesn't work. Do you simply conclude, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't? No. You assume that you must have done something different. You examine your stone. Is it the same kind? You examine your striking motion. You do your best to recreate the conditions under which it worked the first time. Determinism is absolutely fundamental to a rational approach to the world. I emphasize that so the import of the failure of determinism will be clear. We are still very, very far from having fully integrated the psychological shock of it. Objectivity is equally crucial to our understanding of and relationship to the world. It says that there is a reality out there that can be observed, measured, quantified, and controlled. It is the same for you and for me. Any apparent differences arise merely from the different perspectives or interpretations of an independently existing universe. Its laws are invariant. God does not operate the world according to some changeable whim, nor do its laws operate differently for me than for you. Statements like, "The unicorn was there, really there for me, but not for you," we take to be the very epitome of irrationality. Come on, was it there or wasn't it? The same holds for, "The computer works for you, but not for me, even when I do nothing different." Reason as we know it insists that something must have been different, either between us or in the environment, to make the computer behave differently this time. The aspiration toward objectivity affects nearly every realm of human endeavor, anything that tries to be scientific. It is, in fact, very hard to define such terms as scientific or rational without resorting to some variation of objectivity. In science, the experimenter is supposed to maintain an objective distance from his experiments, assuming that there is no necessary, ineliminable connection between himself and the system under study. In medicine, objectivity is embodied in the controlled double-blind study, which seeks to isolate the objective effects of a therapy so that we know how well it really works independent of the attitudes and foibles of patient or doctor. In agriculture, we might plant two identical fields of crops differing only in one significant variable and measure the difference in yield. In jurisprudence, the judge is supposed to maintain impartiality and consider only the facts. In journalism, the belief in objectivity implies that a reporter is just that, someone who reports whatever facts are already out there. She's not supposed to be actually taking part in those events, for then she would no longer be objective. Together, determinism and objectivity promise us technologies that apply generally and generically. Their standard application produces a predictable result. The person applying them is interchangeable, just as a scientific experiment is supposed to be replicable by any competent experimenter. Machine civilization depends on this interchangeability. Power over the physical universe comes via method and structure. Follow the prescribed procedures and you will get the predicted result, reliably. No matter who prescribes them, the right dose of antibiotics taken according to the objectively determined instructions will cure strep throat. It does not matter the intentions of the cannoneer. The cannonball will follow the same trajectory no matter what, as long as the initial angle and propulsive force are controlled. No less than for a caveman striking flint, technological civilization's mastery of the physical world depends on having reliable, generalizable ways to control it. Or so it would seem. This is the founding philosophy that galvanized the scientific revolutionaries and motivates still the program of understanding and control. For several centuries after Galileo and Newton, the scientific program extended the foundation of control by gaining an ever finer understanding of the reasons and the reason of the world, making ever finer observations of the reality out there, until it got down to the base level of the subatomic realm. Here were to be the building blocks of the determinism and objectivity that embody scientific reason. And then, calamity struck. The calamity for science and reason is simply that at the subatomic level, the very bedrock of the whole edifice of science, determinism, and objectivity do not hold. At the most fundamental level of reality, our scientific intuitions, embodied in the above statements about unicorns and computers, are simply wrong. As a result, the last 8 decades have seen a proliferation of interpretations of quantum mechanics that attempt to reconcile the indeterminacy and observer dependence of the quantum realm with the determinism and objectivity that we know characterizes the world of everyday experience. None of these attempts have been successful, a marked contrast to Newtonian mechanics, which provoked little serious dispute about what it all meant because it fit in with the tide of the times. The present lack of agreement about the interpretation of quantum mechanics, which after all lies at the basis of physics, testifies to its incompatibility with our fundamental ontology. It is beyond the scope of this book to give a thorough summary of precisely how quantum mechanics violates determinism and objectivity. I refer the reader to the vast non-technical literature on the topic, in particular the works of Paul Davies, Nick Herbert, David Wick, Roger Penrose, Fritjof Capra, David Deutsch, and John Joe McFadden. I particularly recommend the last two, Deutsch's The Fabric of Reality, for its lucid exposition of the many worlds interpretation that is currently in vogue, and McFadden's Quantum Evolution for its elegantly clear introduction to the basic paradox of measurement. Quantum mechanics' violation of determinism is somewhat less challenging to conventional beliefs about self and world than its violation of objectivity. So let's start there. Determinism holds that initial conditions completely determine final conditions. In other words, if you do exactly the same experiment twice, you will get the same result. This is a key assumption in the requirement of repeatability used to determine scientific fact. But in quantum mechanics, the assumption is false. Fire a stream of electrons, photons, or indeed any particle through a slit onto a detector screen, and the final detected position of each will be different. The overall distribution of particles is fully described by mathematical equations, but the fate of each individual particle is random. One might veer left, the next right, the next straight through, and there is no explanation for that behavior. It is acausal, which violates a central assumption of the scientific program, that with sufficiently diligent querying of nature, the reason for everything can be found. Here, at the very basis of the reductionist pyramid, matter behaves acausally, unreasonably, a state of affairs so troubling to scientific orthodoxy as to incite Einstein's famous protest, "God does not play dice with the universe." If you are less troubled than Einstein was, perhaps that is because you have not pondered it as deeply as he did. So think about it. There is no reason for the photon's behavior. Why did it take a particular path? The only answer is because it did. Nothing made it veer left or right or go straight. Quantum uncertainty provides us with a new source of metaphor and intuition for human life. Newtonian determinism contributed to the feeling that we too are mere masses, the trajectory of our lives wholly determined by the forces bearing upon us. But perhaps we are more like a quantum particle, whose path is constrained or influenced by outside forces, but behaves as if it made its own choices. The metaphor of quantum mechanics is one of choice, autonomy, self-determination. Forgive me if the following metaphor is a little corny, but perhaps we are hurled through the aperture of our circumstances toward a highly probable destination. We then have the power to choose that one or one far divergent from it. And no one can predict where our path will take us. And no outside power can dictate our choice. In the quantum metaphor, choice is the human counterpart of quantum randomness. Both are irreducible, inalienable properties of the subject in question. We can give reasons for our choices, justifications, and excuses. We can explain why we had to do what we chose to do. But the fact is, there is always a choice. By falling back on justifications, we give away our power. And I wonder if the correspondence between quantum randomness and human choice is mere metaphor. I suspect that if we described photon diffraction to an aborigine, he would say that the particle, too, chooses its path. Random? Feh. Randomness is just a feeble attempt to rescue the world of generic masses and uniform building blocks. What if they are all different? What if each bit of matter is unique? What if the sameness that we impose upon it is a mere projection of our own lot as the standardized consumers and functionaries of the Mumfordian mega-machine? The same indeterminacy that characterizes the path of a particle through an aperture also characterizes the decay of a radioactive atom, the polarity of a photon or electron, and many other properties. But the challenge to our conventional worldview runs much deeper than that, because not only are these measured quantities random, apparently, until they are measured, they don't have any definite status at all. Interference experiments, such as the double-slit experiment, the Stern-Gerlach experiment, and countless others demonstrate that in the absence of measurement or observation, Particles behave as if they occupied all possible states at once. What's more, the very presence of observation can affect the evolution of the system being observed. Even in the absence of any physical force operating between system and observer. In other words, there is no independently existing universe out there, separable from we who observe it. Observer and observed are intimately linked. The distinction ultimately does not even make sense. The discrete and separate self is an illusion. And the Galilean primary qualities that we measure with our instruments are not primary at all, but created through the very act of measurement. Another way to say it is that such properties as distance, time, and form are properties of a relationship between self and universe, not of an independently existing objective universe. The naive concept of existence, represented by the disembodied fork floating in nothingness that we visualized in Chapter 3, is incompatible with modern physics. Like the failure of determinism, the crumbling of objectivity opens the door to a profoundly different set of intuitions and metaphors. Seeing ourselves as isolated subjects in a vast universe, we easily succumb to feelings of powerlessness, alienation, and despair. No more. Just as quantum randomness is the metaphorical counterpart of human choice, quantum measurement is analogous to our interpretation of our experience. Like a quantum measurement, these interpretations take on a creative significance. In interacting with the world and taking its measure, we collapse a plenum of possibility into a single actuality. We are not merely interpreting a reality separate from ourselves. We are, through the act of interpretation, actually causing that reality to come to be. This is what we would expect if the foundational myth of our civilization, the discrete and separate self, is indeed a myth. If that separation is an illusion, then of course the inner world of our interpretations, thoughts, beliefs, and attitudes will have an effect on the outside world that is not really outside. We are now very close to the magical thinking of primitive animists, whose belief in the creative power of word and ritual takes on a new significance. Could the metaphorical implications of quantum mechanics propel us toward a reunion of those long-separated inner and outer worlds? Let us begin imagining what a reunited world would look like for humanity, not as it was 50,000 years ago, but in the context of our long accumulating technology and culture. Even without such speculations, the consequences of failure of determinism and objectivity have so far been too huge for our culture to digest, so antithetical are they to the reigning orthodoxy. The quantum measurement paradox is the inevitable paradox of attempting to weld the observer dependence of the quantum world with the supposed objectivity of the world of everyday experience inhabited by our discrete separate selves. Quantum mechanics invalidates the discrete and separate self. Because quantum mechanics represents such a profound challenge to our very self-conception, for 80 years, scientists and philosophers have gone through paroxysms of interpretation to somehow mediate the two realms of non-objective, acausal quantum events and the classical reality we think we experience. Again, none of these attempts has been successful. On the practical level, most deny the extension of indeterminacy and observer dependence into the macroscopic world, essentially by claiming that quantum uncertainty tends to routinely cancel out. Approximating classical mechanics on the scale of everyday experience. Thus, while there is a finite chance that a marble flung through a hole will diffract onto a non-classical path, this chance is so close to zero that it can be ignored. While this solves the practical problem of why classical mechanics work so well for, say, designing machines and bridges, it doesn't deal with the ontological problem. What is the fundamental nature of reality? Moreover, as the founders of quantum mechanics, particularly Schrödinger, realized, the ontological problem does not go away, but becomes especially pressing when quantum events are magnified into classical observations, which is essentially what a quantum measurement does. Some unconventional thinkers, such as Roger Penrose and John Joe McFadden, argue that quantum effects are projected into macroscopic reality routinely in living systems, and not just in the contrived conditions of a physics lab. Some, more radical, even cite indeterminacy as an escape clause from mechanism that allows free will. Others cite quantum phenomena as evidence to support various approaches to healing and spirituality. Such speculations range from the ignorant to the highly sophisticated. But I believe that someday science will establish a quantum explanation for many presently unexplained, and for the most part unacknowledged, phenomena. However, a detailed discussion of the measurement paradox and the dominant misunderstanding of decoherence will have to await a future book. If you read my words carefully, you will see I claim no direct link between quantum phenomena and the world of human experience. For example, I am not claiming that quantum indeterminacy proves we have free will. Quantum mechanics has given us a new way of thinking, a new kind of logic, and a new source of metaphor. These already may be powerful enough to transform our civilization. The counterintuitive aspects of quantum mechanics I have described are only counter to those intuitions that are contingent on the modern conception of self and world. To people before the age of separation was well underway, descriptions of quantum phenomena such as "it occupied two positions simultaneously," or "it wasn't there until you looked for it," or "it was there for you but not for me," may have not seemed paradoxical at all. To them, there was no absolute distinction between observer and observed, imagination and reality, human and nature, self and other. To the extent that such distinctions existed, their provisional nature was recognized, perhaps as a play, a creative artifice. Hence, the original identity cited in Chapter 2 between ritual and reality, and in the original language between the name and the thing named. The mind of the primitive is often irksomely irrational to the Western visitor. I must admit having suffered the same annoyance in my early encounters with New Agey people who would, it seemed, taunt me with such statements as, "It's true for you, but not for me." I would say, I believe that if Ki really exists, we would have detected it with scientific instruments, and my friend would respond, "That belief is why you cannot detect it with your instruments." I would say, "I don't believe out-of-body experiences are possible," and he'd say, "Then for you they are not possible." It was maddening. I don't mean for me. I mean not possible for real. "Then for you it is not possible for real." Arg! What I meant by for real was objectively. One friend, the healer and musician Chad Parks, tried to explain a psychic invisibility technique taught to him by some, to me, dubious New Age guru. People choose not to look at you, or they simply don't notice you. But surely, if they looked, the light rays bouncing off your body would still reach their eyes, I said, "so you're not really invisible." To them, I am. A similar situation arises in one of Carlos Castaneda's books, in which the narrator, trying to get a grip on Don Juan's shamanic powers, challenges him. But what if someone was waiting in ambush on your path? Surely you couldn't stop a bullet, could you? No, I could not stop a bullet, but I would not take that path. Castaneda could have continued. But what of the situation required you to take that path? And Don Juan could have replied in kind, then I would not enter that situation. In the prior example, I could have proposed to Chad an experiment. Okay, make yourself invisible. I bet I can still see you. He would have said, it won't work. I am already here for you. His invisibility is essentially untestable because the very grounds for objective testing embody a conflict of assumptions. It is testable only in an objective universe, and it works only in a non-objective universe. The whole idea of certainty of knowledge, built through objective reasoning, is only as sound as the objectivity at its basis. Question that, and we question the soundness of the entire edifice of experimentally derived knowledge. The reason that primitive and New Age logic seems irrational is that it is irrational. Reason, according to David Bohm's definition that I quote in Chapter 3, is the application of an abstracted relationship onto something new. A non-objective world defies such abstraction. If the world out there reflects in some way the inner world, then reason is but one of several cognitive tools for creating and defining our experiences. Reason is still a valid and useful tool. It is only when it becomes a reflexive habit rather than a conscious instrument that it is limiting. Professional skeptics are fond of railing at the abysmal stupidity of their opponents, who seem dispossessed of that key function of higher cognition, reason. Like a fish unaware that it is wet, these critics rarely perceive their own immersion in assumptions of self and world that constitutionally limit them to certain narrow modes of cognition, those that we call rational. These are powerful in a certain domain, having enabled us to build the towering edifice of our civilization. They are behind the vast program to engineer the world and remake nature. As this program falters, we open to the possibility of other modes of cognition and relationship. As quantum mechanics slowly replaces our Newtonian Cartesian intuitions with those that are non-dualistic, all of the fruits of separation will lose their deepest rationale. For even if conventional philosophy is right that quantum indeterminacy and observer dependence have no practical consequences for consciousness, mind, and self, even if no one ever proves that our level of matter departs appreciably from classical description, there still lurks at the bottom an implacable exception to the claim that the universe is just like that. If only by way of metaphor, quantum mechanics confers upon us a new logic, a new framework of possibility. No longer will the discrete and separate self be the only conceivable, the only cogent way of understanding the world. Quantum mechanics heralds a momentous shift in our intuitions that will rapidly accelerate as the failure of the old ways of life and thought becomes increasingly obvious. Just as the regime of separation both set the stage for and was reinforced by its apotheosis in the science of Newton and Descartes, so also will quantum mechanics quicken the emerging realization of our interconnectedness with each other and all of nature, which will in turn allow us to more fully digest quantum theory's profound ontological consequences. In other words, quantum theory is both a cause and an effect, a harbinger and a symptom of a larger shift in consciousness. armed with the intuitions, or at least the metaphorical possibilities that quantum mechanics foretells, the beliefs of primitive humans will take on a new vitality, relevance, and import. Already we feel their pull, as the popularity of Native American spirituality testifies. That this form of cultural capital is rapidly co-opted and converted into money does not alter the kernel of its appeal. Already, we are becoming more willing to believe that our thoughts, words, and actions have a power beyond their classical physical description as mere shifting of masses and flux of chemicals. Already, we grow more at ease with the idea of a fluid reality, not separate and absolute, but defined by our relationship to it and molded by our beliefs. Little do we realize that the stage is being set for a wholly different science and a wholly different technology, no longer based on the premise of separation and no longer reinforcing that premise. And no aspect of human life will remain unchanged. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. Truth without certainty. If particle physics is a foundation of the reductionist program described in Chapter 3, then mathematics and formal logic is the bedrock upon which that foundation rests. To truly fulfill the technological program of complete control, we must first achieve a certainty of knowledge, so that results follow undeviatingly from expectations, conclusions from premises, and function from design. In this view, if a machine doesn't work or a design fails, it can only be because some variable was left uncontrolled, i.e., the knowledge of initial conditions was incomplete. When every factor is accounted for, every variable measured, every force captured in a mathematical equation, then the predictability of a physical system is no less dependable than the mathematics that underlies it. But how dependable is this mathematics? In the imaginary future of Leibniz and Laplace, where all linguistic meaning is fully precise and all of science fully mathematized, any dispute can be resolved by straightforward calculation, without doubt or controversy, and all the truths of nature will be laid bare. Mathematics, after all, is the epitome of certainty, in which conclusions are reached not by persuasion, but by formal deductive proof, indisputable unless logic itself is violated. But how do we know that mathematics is sound? How do we know that there are not hidden contradictions buried in the axioms of arithmetic? And equally important, how do we know that all truth can be reached starting from those axioms? As physics was placed on an axiomatic footing, and more fields of knowledge appealed to mathematics for their legitimacy, these questions took on increasing urgency around the end of the 19th century. The axiomatic method, which originated with Euclid, is implicit in today's notion of scientific rigor. It starts with explicit definitions of terms to be used, and the assumptions one is operating from. After all, how can reasoning be sound if its very terms are ambiguous? You start from basic definitions and premises and build from those. In mathematics, the necessity of the axiomatic approach was highlighted by various paradoxes in set theory that demonstrated the ultimate incoherency of naive, non-axiomatic definitions of a set. For example, consider Russell's paradox. The set of all sets that are not members of themselves. Is that set a member of itself? By definition, if it is, then it isn't, and if it isn't, then it is. Hence, the necessity of axioms implicitly defining what is and is not a set. Axioms were also formulated for arithmetic. Naively, we think we know what addition and multiplication are, but do we really? The axioms of arithmetic define them formally. The program to put all of mathematics and by implication eventually all of science on a firm axiomatic footing was articulated by the French mathematician David Hilbert, and its culmination was to be a proof that such axioms systems, particularly arithmetic, were both sound and complete. Sound in that no contradictory results could arise from them. Complete in that all true statements could be proven from them. At the same time, it seemed intuitively obvious. Surely anything true was also provable. How else could you know it were true? How could you differentiate it from any other assertion? In a sense, the entire Cartesian ambition to become the lords and possessors of nature hinged upon the completeness proof. For it would establish that no mystery, no truth, is beyond the purview of human logic. Starting with a formal axiom system, one can proceed according to the rules of logic to derive mechanically and unthinkingly all possible proofs from these axioms. A computer could do it. And even though computers didn't exist in 1900, the mechanical nature of axiomatic proof seemed to promise that Leibniz's vision would come true. To settle any dispute, and indeed to eventually arrive at all truth, we would but need to say, let us calculate. Imagine, then, the sense of bewilderment that followed Gödel's famous incompleteness theorem of 1931, which destroyed all hope of ever completing Hilbert's program. Usually presented in popular literature as demonstrating that there exist true statements of arithmetic that cannot be proven from the axioms, Gödel's theorem is actually a bit more subtle than that. I will present the theorem here in a little more depth, because its subtleties have both direct and metaphoric consequences for the scientific program and technological program. The divergence of truth and provability in Gödel's theorem can only be understood in the context of the distinction between a formal theory and an interpretation of that theory. A formal theory is a set of all theorems deducible from a given set of axioms according to the usual rules of logic. Its interpretation is whatever real or abstract system the theory describes. To take a familiar example, the geometrical axioms of Euclid generate a theory, one interpretation of which is the idealized lines, points, angles, and so forth drawn on a flat surface. One interpretation of the theory of arithmetic is the set of natural numbers we use to count, add, and multiply. Provability is a property of sentences written in the formal language of the theory. Truth is a property of their counterparts in the real world. For example, in the formal language, the sentence XY equals, and then a set of other symbols, is provable from the seven basic axioms of formal arithmetic named Q. And its interpretation, if the product of two numbers is zero, then at least one of those numbers must be zero, is true in real-life arithmetic. That assertion seems quite obvious, but how can we be sure? In other words, how can we prove it? Only by abstracting from the real-world example of theory a set of definitions, here's what addition really means, embedded in axioms. But then the question arises, how can we know whether the theory really corresponds completely to the interpretation? Indeed, the seven axioms of Q are so minimal that it is impossible to prove basic arithmetical facts such as A A plus B equals B plus A. It is impossible to prove from Q that you can get to every number eventually by counting from zero. Such inconveniences are easily dealt with, however, by adding them in as new axioms. The ultimate goal of Hilbert's program, and indeed of the scientific program of complete understanding, would be to add in as axioms all unprovable statements whose interpretations are true. You would then have a complete axiomization of reality, the ultimate conversion of nature to number. The separate human realm would finally encompass all of reality. What Gödel proved was that this is impossible, that there is no way of adding enough axioms to prove every true sentence, i.e., every sentence whose interpretation is true. An infinity of axioms would be required, but even this is not the deepest problem. The problem is that there is no effective procedure to generate that infinity, no finite means to make the theory complete. You cannot say, let every sentence that is true in such and such an interpretation be an axiom, because there is no way to tell what those sentences are. In other words, there is necessarily something missing in any mathematical description of reality. There is no finite means to encompass all truth in a system of labels and quantities, which is essentially what a formal system is. Even without quantum indeterminacy, the scientific program is doomed to failure from the start. Doomed as well is the whole notion of reductionistic rationality as a sure guide to truth, the approach mentioned above of starting any problem by laying out rigorous definitions. By limiting knowledge to what can be proven, we exclude large swaths of the truth. And it gets worse. The above state of affairs would be acceptable if the truths left inaccessible were unimportant ones, contrived sentences of arithmetic like the one Gödel constructed for his proof. But as soon became apparent through the work of Turing, Post, and more recently Gregory Chaitin, it's not just a few recondite corners of mathematics that are impervious to proof, but the vast majority of all mathematical facts. The very idea of rational understanding is to reduce the complex to the simple, to find the reasons underlying things. The quintessential example of this is the reduction of the complex paths of planets in the sky to Newton's universal law of motion. What Turing proved is that there are important mathematical questions that cannot be answered that way, but only along the lines of, because that's the way it is. His famous halting problem showed that there is no general means of determining whether a random Turing machine, an idealized computer, will eventually halt given a certain input. No means, that is, except to actually try it out. There are specific methods for some Turing machines, but no universal method, no finite formula or set of instructions, nothing that could be programmed into a computer. There can be no general theory of why Turing machines halt. Chaitin has extended this result even further to observe that almost all mathematical fact is unprovable, and even worse, that mathematical truth is random in the sense of algorithmic information theory. There is no rhyme or reason to the truth. Nothing that could be understood in the finite, standard terms required to bring reality into the human realm of control. Mathematics has sealed the fate of the age-old attempt to substitute chaotic, unpredictable reality with a controllable, artificial version of it. However fine our mapping of reality, However sophisticated our modeling, something will always be missing, and this limitation is inherent in the map itself. Of course, a map, a set of definitions, an axiom system can be useful. But when we mistake it for the real thing, then we are marooned in a finite world of our own making, a projection of our own assumptions, a tiny subset of truth delimited from the very beginning by what we hold to be self-evident. As Chaitin puts it, in other words, the current map of mathematics reflects what our tools are currently able to handle, not what is really out there. The danger is that, blinded by our assumptions, we reject actual experiential data with the thought, "It isn't true because it couldn't be true." This is precisely what has happened in many branches of science, which have become so mired in their principles that they cannot countenance anomalous phenomena, no matter how well documented. We make an analogous mistake in everyday life whenever beliefs blind us to experience. Consider, for example, the shy teenager who is so convinced she is unattractive to boys that she is oblivious to their attentions, interpreting secret admirer notes as mockery and compliments as sympathetic attempts to cheer her up. The results of Gödel, Turing, and Chaitin imply a different way of pursuing knowledge that foregoes certainty in favor of utility. In the absence of irrefragable truths that exist out there, the inquirer's relation to the world becomes paramount. In mathematics, a researcher can add new axioms onto a formal system, justifying them either with computational evidence or merely by the appeal of the results they can prove. In this way, subjectivity creeps back into mathematics. One body of theory derives from the axioms of set theory with the axiom of choice. Another body of theory from the axioms without it. One body of theory derives from the addition of the continuum hypothesis as an axiom. Another from the addition of its negation. In computation, many results follow from assuming that there is no polynomial time algorithm for solving NP hard problems, an assumption widely accepted based on computational evidence, and the repeated frustration of mathematicians' best efforts to find polynomial time algorithm. In geometry, the inclusion of non-Euclidean axioms provides a tool for understanding curved space-time, just as the Euclidean axioms describe geometry on a flat surface. We can playfully try out different axiom systems to come up with different descriptions of reality, parts of reality, or aspects of the universe. If, my dear reader, you have become lost in these complexities, let me emphasize a key point. It is simply that in mathematics as well as physics, there is not always a reason why. Sometimes things are true just because they are. Have you ever heard someone say, "Oh, yeah? If it's true, then prove it." Unconsciously, we have learned to equate truth and provability, just as we have learned to value reason over intuition. Hilbert's program was just one manifestation of our craving for certainty, for an indisputable source of truth outside of ourselves. The same impulse underlies the ubiquitous elevation of experts in our society, and the giving over of more and more of our autonomy to external authorities. It also underlies many religious cults, in which certainty comes from the guru, as well as Christian fundamentalism, which looks to yet another external authority, the Bible, for an indisputable source of truth. The doctrine of biblical inerrancy is a religious counterpart of the scientific ambition to axiomize reality. Here is certainty. No longer is it necessary to look within oneself to know truth. It is all laid out in black and white. We are no longer divine creators of our world, only receivers, only consumers. Today, all hope of ever achieving such certainty is ended. Of course we can, like the Christian fundamentalist, the cult follower, or the dogmatic scientist, choose to remain ensconced in our axiom system and refuse to explore any truth that lays outside it. But such certitude comes at a high price: insularity, stagnation, and cut off from new worlds of knowledge and experience. In fact, the crumbling of certainty is incredibly liberating. Its effects are similar to the effects of the failure of determinism and objectivity in the realm of physics. Truth, like being, ceases to be an independent quality separate from ourselves. Both begin to make sense only as a relationship. Divorced from logical certainty, divorced from proof, what can truth mean? The only satisfactory answer that I found is that truth is a state of integrity. When faced with two different interpretations of an experience, instead of gathering more and more evidence to decide which is true, the new metaphor calls us to simply choose one or the other, depending on which fits with greater integrity into all that we are, and more importantly, all that we strive to be. We create who we are through the truths we choose. Does that statement sound dangerous to you? Does it seem to give license to play fast and loose with the truth, to ignore the evidence and blindly maintain a self-serving interpretation of reality? Does it allow us to justify anything we want by saying, "It's my truth"? Actually, it has the opposite effect. When we choose truth consciously, in knowing self-definition, that choice takes on a gravity absent from ordinary reasons and justifications. If we understand truth as a creative choice, we will be all the more conscientious in choosing. Returning to our mathematical metaphor, truth is a property of an interpretation, not of proof, not of reasons. So in choosing a truth, we are choosing an interpretation of our world. That interpretation, in turn, generates new experiences consistent with it. Our choice of the truths we live by has world-creating power. Whether inside or outside of science, we might see the quest for truth not as an encompassing of more and more facts, not as a growing certainty about the world, but rather as a path of self-understanding and conscious creativity. When truth is, as in mathematics, often beyond certainty, beyond even reason, then how do we recognize it? How do we choose a belief and its opposite? We are left with integrity, which we can clarify by asking, "Is that me? Is that the universe I choose to live in? Is that the reality I wish to create?" We are not discrete observers, separate from the universe that we observe, able only to discover what it is. We are creators. Let me give you an example. Through a few personal experiences and extensive reading, I have come into contact with many phenomena that conventional science does not accept. At some point, I was faced with a crisis of belief, a choice between two different interpretations, each logically coherent. They went something like this. 1. My physical experience of ki was a fantasy induced by the unusual circumstances of the dojo and the culture shock of being in Taiwan. The hundreds of apparently normal, sincere, and humble practitioners were similarly deluded, except for those consciously conspiring in a hoax.